You're listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit nakedbiblepodcast.com and click on the support link in the upper right-hand corner. If you're new to the podcast and Dr. Heiser's approach to the Bible, click on New Start Here at nakedbiblepodcast.com.
Welcome to the Naked Bible Podcast, episode 66, Leviticus chapter 4. I'm your layman, Trey Strickland, and he's the scholar, Dr. Michael Heiser. Hey, Mike, how you doing?
Very good. Glad to be back. I was on a vacation a little while ago and back in the swing of things in full here, and just glad to be here.
Well, good. I hope your vacation, you got lots of rest.
No, not at all. It's taken me a couple weeks to recover.
You need a vacation from your vacation.
Yeah. Well, maybe someday I'll get that, but who knows? Just you move from the extra chaos in a different place to the normal chaos is about the way it works. All right. Well, we're going to be doing Leviticus 4 today, but as we begin, I want to say something a little bit about chapters 4 and 5, just by way of introduction. Both of these chapters concern sacrificial laws governing sacrifices of expiation. So there's some cleansing going on here, but we're going to be talking about what that exactly means and doesn't mean as we go through both of these chapters. These are sacrifices, again, to secure atonement and forgiveness, and again, some cleansing going on, but sort of our popular conception of that is going to be a little bit different than what we actually see in Leviticus 4 and 5 in the biblical text. So in both cases, again, both of these chapters, 4 and 5, just to preview what we're going to be talking about today and, of course, sort of set up, the next time, these sacrifices in these chapters are only efficacious when it comes to unintentional offenses or unintentional sins, unintentional transgressions. Whenever an individual Israelite from the lowest social class all the way up to the high priest is guilty of an inadvertent offense or failing to do what the law requires, again, in some unintentional way, some sort of transgression by ignorance or inadvertence, then expiation through sacrifice is required. They do not apply to defiant acts or premeditated sins, or premeditated offenses or crimes. The laws of the Torah contain no sacrificial expiation for intentional or premeditated sins. There's no vicarious remedy or some ritual that will absolve a person who intentionally defied God or, again, committed some crime. Now, as we'll see, both sacrifice and repayment were commanded and, again, were effectual with respect to only unintentional wrongs and violations, and that's whether they're committed against God or other people. But the things that are premeditated, that just isn't the case. And that's kind of contrary to the way we think about sacrifice, because when we think about Old Testament sacrifices, we tend to filter that material through the New Testament theology of atonement and forgiveness, and that covers everything. That is not the case with the Old Testament. Now, there's an illustration of this that we probably already know from the Old Testament, and that is in Numbers 35, 9 through 34. I'm not going to read that, but that's the avenger of blood situation. There were certain cities of refuge set up when Israel moved into the land, and that was specifically for the protection of a person who unintentionally took a human life. And again, they could go to these cities, they could flee there, they were safe from punishment, death penalty. They were safe there as long as they stayed in those cities during the term of the high priest at the time. If they rejected that provision and ventured outside the city of refuge to which they had fled, then they were fair game. But Numbers 35 sort of illustrates this idea, even with something as serious as taking a human life, if it was unintentional, there was some sort of provision made for you, as opposed to if this was deliberate, there is no provision. There's no way to sort of deal with this and get around it other than the death penalty. Well, that's sort of a familiar case, and it's the same principle, the same idea is true with the less familiar, that if you sinned, I know the King James translates with a high hand, again, shaking your fist at God, that kind of thing. If you sinned defiantly or premeditatively, that is not what the sacrificial system was for. It was for the people who did unintentional things. inadvertent offenses. In that case, okay, we can deal with this. There's something that we can do to take care of this problem. But if it was on the other side, boy, you know, it sure stinks to be you. You know, that's the kind of thing that you're dealing with in Old Testament law. Now, I want to quote Levine here a little bit. We've mentioned Baruch Levine before in his commentary on Leviticus is probably one of the two sort of premier go-to references for Old Testament ritual. And he says this, in the case of premeditated sins, Old Testament law dealt directly with the offender, imposing real punishments to prevent recurrences, i.e. the death penalty. It's not going to recur if you take care of it that way. Or recurring restitution, where loss or injury to another person had occurred. Ritual expiation was restricted to situations where a reasonable doubt existed as to the intentionality of the sin or the offense. The mistaken notion that ritual worship could atone for criminality or intentional religious desecration was persistently attacked by the prophets of Israel, who considered it a major threat to the entire covenantal relationship between Israel and God. Okay, unquote. Now, Levine gives examples like Isaiah 1, where God says, you know, I essentially, you know, purify your hearts, you know, do what's right instead of just bringing a sacrifice. Well, this kind of language again points to the problem of people committing deliberately sins and crimes and then bringing sacrifice like, oh, this will take care of it. Where the prophets are saying, no, that really doesn't take care of it. What God wants is a new heart, a different heart. And this is not satisfactory. Again, what Levine is saying is passages like that feed off of or you know, sort of they have their hooks into this idea that the sacrificial system was really about unintentional violations, not defiant sins. Now, Levine adds, here he is again, the laws of chapters 4 and 5 do not specify all the offenses for which such sacrifices are mandated. We may assume, as did the rabbis, that there is a correspondence between those offenses requiring expiatory offerings and those punishable by the penalty known as karet, which in translation is cutting off of the offender from the community. The expiatory sacrifices were required for inadvertent transgressions. If someone committed a transgression defiantly, that would bring upon the offender the penalty of karat. Again, that's a Hebrew term for to cut off. You say, well, what does cut off mean? Levine says, at some early stage, karet probably involved actual banishment from the community. Karet was often combined with more stringent punishments, even death, like the death penalty. It is sometimes perceived as punishment meted out directly by God, in contrast to that imposed by the community and its leaders for offenses committed against God. Karet was inflicted for a variety of religious sins, such as desecration of the Sabbath, eating leaven on Passover, or committing adultery, unquote. So what Levine's getting at here is, again, the sacrificial system was there so that a person wouldn't be cut off from the community, either by death penalty or by banishment. But for those who sin defiantly, that was what happened to you. There is no sacrifice for that. We don't just, you know, kill an animal and it's all taken care of and forgotten. Again, some transgressions, you know, you're going to, you know, there's going to be different things that happen as we go through Leviticus. You know, we'll describe them, but just as a general principle, sacrifice was for unintentional or inadvertent, you know, offenses. The stuff that was deliberate, you were cut off, either death penalty or you're banished. Again, sacrifice doesn't cut it there, pun intended. Now, as far as Leviticus 4 and 5, these cover two sacrifices. Chapter 4, which we're going to talk about today, is the katat, which is usually rendered sin offering. I'm going to offer a different translation for that and explain why. And then chapter 5 is the asham, which is usually translated guilt offering. Now, we're going to obviously focus on katat, the sin offering, in this chapter because that's the whole of Leviticus 4. We need to realize, as we jump into this, I'm going to read the first 20 or so verses, that there's actually two different katat sacrifices in chapter 4 that actually spill into chapter 5. They're both called the sin offering. One is chapter 4 around verses 3 to 21. We're basically going to read this one in full. And that was the sin offering for when the chief priest or the collective community of Israel happened to commit an inadvertent offense. So there's a procedure for that. The second one that picks up around verse 22 in chapter 4 and spills into chapter 5, was the sin offering procedure for an individual Israelite, again, who was not a priest and not the collective community, but just a sole individual Israelite or a tribal chief. There was a procedure for those. And there's a difference between the two. Really, it comes down to what was done with the blood that sort of illustrates a principle that we're going to get into in a few moments. So let's jump into Leviticus 4. And I'm going to read, again, probably the first 20 or so verses here and mix in a few comments, and this will set up what we're going to do the rest of the episode. So Leviticus 4 says, "The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to the people of Israel, saying, if anyone sins unintentionally in any of the Lord's commandments about things not to be done, and does any one of them, if it is the anointed priest who sins," this is verse 3, "thus bringing guilt on the people, then he," the anointed priest, "shall offer for the sin that he has committed a bull from the herd without blemish to the Lord for a sin offering. He shall bring the bull to the entrance of the tent of meeting before the Lord, and lay his hand on the head of the bull, and kill the bull before the Lord. And the anointed priest shall take some of the blood of the bull, and bring it into the tent of meeting, and the priest shall dip his finger in the blood and sprinkle part of the blood 7 times before the Lord in front of the veil of the sanctuary. And the priest shall put some of the blood on the horns of the altar of fragrant incense before the Lord that is in the tent of meeting, and all the rest of the blood of the bull he shall pour out at the base of the altar of burnt offering that is at the entrance of the tent of meeting." Verse 8, "And all the fat of the bull of the sin offering he shall remove from it, the fat that covers the entrails, and the fat that's on the entrails, and the two kidneys, with the fat that is on them at the loins, and the long lobe of the liver he shall remove with the kidneys." Verse 10, "just as are taken from the ox of the sacrifice of the peace offerings." So it's the same, you know, procedure. "And the priest shall burn them on the altar of burnt offering. But the skin of the bull and all its flesh with its head, its legs, its entrails, and its dung, and all the rest of the bull he shall carry outside the camp to a clean place, to the ash heap, and shall burn it up on a fire of wood. On the ash heap it shall be burned up." Now, we stopped here at verse 12, and I want to summarize a little bit of what we've done to this point, or at least what we've read. You'll notice that only the blood and the fatty portions on the internal organs are used in this ritual. Now, the fatty portions, the fat on the organs, are the same as what we saw in earlier episodes associated with the peace offering. But the rest is just discarded. It's taken outside the camp, burned on the ash heap, as we read there in the last verse we read, verse 12. You'll also notice there's no community meal. I mean, nobody, you know, consumes, eats, you know, part of the offering here. The part that is used, again, the blood and the fatty portions are put on the altar and they're given over to the Lord. And then the blood is applied only to the sanctuary, or, you know, points of the sanctuary, parts of it, and the sancta, that is the sacred objects. Scholars refer to this as blood manipulation, by the way. You might hear me use that term. But essentially where the blood is applied. And in this case, it's only the sanctuary and different sacred objects. There's no meal here. So what this tells us sort of right off the bat is that the real concern of the sin offering is to maintain the purity of the sanctuary, or, you know, to cleanse it, to purge it from impurity, to protect it from infection, right? Probably be a good idea, a good way to think of it. So the sacrifice is about the purity of the sanctuary against any sort of defilement or infection. Now, what you're going to notice is that this particular part of Leviticus 4, again, the first 12 verses here, relating to what happens when a priest inadvertently commits an offense, or the entire congregation, which the priest sort of represents. In this case, the blood is going to be put on certain things that it is not applied to later in the chapter when the second sin offering procedure is described, the one that's for the ordinary Israelite or for a tribal leader. There's going to be a bit of a difference, and we'll talk about that when we come to it, as to why there is this difference. So let's jump back into verse 13. "If the whole congregation of Israel sins unintentionally, and the thing is hidden from the eyes of the assembly, and they do any one of the things that by the Lord's commandments ought not to be done, and they realize their guilt. When the sin which they have committed becomes known, the assembly shall offer a bull from the herd for a sin offering and bring it to the front of the tent of meeting. So far, it sounds pretty much the same. The elders of the congregation shall lay their hands on the head of the bull before the Lord. That's verse 15. And the bull shall be killed before the Lord. Then the anointed priest shall bring some of the blood of the bull into the tent of meeting, and the priest shall dip his finger in the blood and sprinkle it seven times before the Lord in front of the veil. And he shall put some of the blood on the horns of the altar that is in the tent of meeting before the Lord, and the rest of the blood he shall pour out at the base of the altar of burnt offering that is at the entrance of the tent of meeting, and all its fat he shall take from it and burn on the altar. Thus shall he do with the bull, as he did with the bull of the sin offering, so shall he do with this. And the priest shall make atonement for them, and they shall be forgiven. And he shall carry the bull outside the camp and burn it up as he burned the first bull. It is the sin offering for the assembly. So here you have, by the time you get to verse 20, you've got two procedures really that are part of kind of, you know, one concern. We've got the first part was a priest. Second part is the congregation of Israel sinning unintentionally in verse 13. So when the congregation sins, you know, as a whole, and again, there are various circumstances where something like that can happen, then the procedure is basically, again, the same for the priest, because the priest represented the whole congregation. When a particular Israelite isn't known as the one who did something wrong, then the priest has to sort of represent everybody, just to sort of catch, you know, the offender. If there's, again, some sort of imprecise circumstance, you can't, you know, just point to one lay person or tribal leader or something like that. So when the priest is involved, here's the point. When the priest is involved in some way needing the sin offering procedure, the blood is going to be taken into the tent of meeting. It's taken into, you know, onto holy ground here inside the tent, inside the tabernacle, as it were, the holy place, to be more precise. And it's going to be sprinkled. You're going to have the blood applied to the horns of the altar of the incense that's in front, you know, of where, in front of the veil. On the other side is the Ark of the Covenant. The blood sort of travels inside, okay, the holy place. Doesn't penetrate the Holy of Holies. That's only going to happen once a year in Leviticus 16 with the Day of Atonement. But it travels inside. You know, when we get from Leviticus 4:22, which says when a leader, tribal leader, sins doing unintentionally this or that, and then verse 27, if any one of the common people sins unintentionally, those procedures aren't going to be exactly the ones that we just read. You won't see the blood travel into the holy place, because it's not specifically connected with a priest. The priest didn't sin unintentionally, and the priest didn't have to represent the whole populace in the case of sort of an unknown person, the congregation as a whole sinning. Okay, in those circumstances, since the priest is sort of involved in the violation in some way, either himself or he has to represent the people who committed the violation, the whole congregation. When the priest is involved in some way in the violation, then the blood that's used for the sin offering will go into the holy place. But if it's somebody else, tribal leader, common person, you don't have that. We'll talk a little bit about that as we keep going. Now, what I want to do here, I'm not going to read the rest of the chapter because there's a lot of repetition in it, but you have the basic, you got the two basic categories, priest representing the congregation, and then you have tribal leader and common person. Those are the two sort of categories of the sin offering. And, you know, we've discussed that. So what I want to do from this point on is to talk about certain terms and concepts that you'll read in this chapter, and then talk about, you know, what they mean, you know, what the point is. So let's talk about first this term unintentionally. Now, the term here comes from the Hebrew verb shagag, which means to err or to wander, something like that. And it speaks of inadvertence. Again, maybe a better way to say it would be this term is used in contrast to other terms and other descriptions that make it clear that a violation, a deliberate violation, is in view. When you want it to be clear that, no, we're not talking about a deliberate violation, we want to contrast what's happening with a deliberate, a defiant offense, this is the verb that Leviticus uses, shagag, to err, to make a mistake. a sort of an honest mistake. So again, it speaks of inadvertence. In other words, the offender might be unaware of a particular law or some nuance of the law. They might be unaware that something they did was actually a violation of a law they did know. They just weren't sure that it was a violation or not. And then the priest says, yep, you know, that's a violation. And you say, well, I didn't know that. Okay, well, now we need to bring a sin offering, because inadvertence, unintentionality is acceptable. So Levine put it this way: inadvertence with respect to the nature of the act itself would occur by way of example if a person, let's say, ate forbidden fat, chalev, thinking it was ordinary fat, shuman, again, from an offering, you know, because there were only certain fatty portions due for the Lord. And you say, oh, I ate something that was for the Lord. I didn't realize, I couldn't visually tell what was sacred fat and what was common fat. And the priest, okay, we get that. We understand that. We know you didn't do it on purpose. You're not stealing from God defiantly or on purpose. You're okay. You know, we can take care of that with a sin offering. No problem. So I hope you're catching that the prevailing assumption of the whole system, a system that allows atonement, allows the taking care of, the cleansing of inadvertent or unintentional violation, the prevailing assumption is that an Israelite, a good Israelite, would seek to obey God's laws. They wouldn't be seeking to disobey. They wouldn't be rebels. And they wouldn't be, you know, defiant. Everybody would be trying to keep in line, you know, to obey the law. And when you slipped up, it's okay. What's not okay is when you're defiant and you premeditatively do something that is contrary to God's law. Unwitting offenses could be taken care of. The other ones, different story. So that's unintentionally, again, from shagag to err, to make a mistake. Now let's talk about sin offering. Now this one is a little more complicated. And as I telegraphed early in the episode, I'm going to suggest a different translation for katat, which is the Hebrew term typically rendered sin offering, because I think it's confusing. Again, because when the average Christian reads this sin offering and they read terms like atonement and shall be forgiven, they're filtering that content through the New Testament work of Jesus. Okay, folks, the New Testament work of Jesus is better than this. This is better than the Old Testament system. The Old Testament system didn't have sacrifices for defiant, deliberate sin. New Testament, the work of Jesus, covers everything. But again, to understand, like the book of Hebrews, why Jesus is better. Okay, and that's a big theme of Hebrews. Jesus is better than this aspect of the Old Testament, that aspect. He's a better priest. He's a better, you know, sacrifice. He's a better this. He's a better that. To understand the part of the book of Hebrews that talks about the sacrifices, how Jesus' sacrifice is better, you have to understand the Old Testament system, and you'll see that it's better. Again, we often don't get that. We think, oh, it's better because it's not icky. There's no blood. You know, we don't have to kill an animal. Well, okay, that's true, but there's a lot more to it than that. So let's go back here and talk about the term katat in Hebrew. Now, just all by itself, you take it out of context, you're just looking it up in a lexicon. Katat can either mean sin offering, or that's usually the way it's translated anyway, or sin. So you got the same word for sin and the same word for the offering that's supposed to take care of the sin. That's a little confusing. And it's one of the reasons why sin offering probably isn't the best way to handle this. Second, in view of what's done with the blood in this chapter, again, the point of the ritual being to maintain the purity of the sanctuary, to protect it from infection by people who have become infected by sinning unintentionally. They become unfit to occupy sacred space. In view of that, what's actually done with the blood, some have opted for purification offering. Now, I actually like that, and I'm not alone here, but I think there's actually, rather than just saying, hey, I like the sound of that better, there's actually an exegetical reason why that is the best way to translate this. And to understand this, you have to know a little bit of Hebrew. We'll get to that point, but I want to throw in a third complication here that I think will help justify the idea of translating katat as purification offering or something like that. Here's the other complicating factor, not factor number three here, is that sometimes in Leviticus and other passages, the quote-unquote sin offering, the katat, is required for people who have committed no moral offense at all. In fact, it's required for simple ritual impurity. For instance, in Leviticus 5, the quote-unquote sin offering is used for those who have been defiled by touching a corpse. Okay, well, I mean, that happens. You didn't commit a moral offense. You didn't sin against God, you know, that kind of thing. But you came into contact, again, unintentionally. It's not like you're going out, where's a dead body so I can poke it, so I can, you know, poke God in the eye and sin defiantly. No, it just in the course of daily life, let's say, you know, your grandpa's living with you there in the tent and he dies and you catch him, you try to revive him. Well, you touched a dead body. You know, you're unclean. Well, you need a sin offering. You say, well, I didn't sin. Well, that's the point. The sin offering isn't about, again, like deliberate moral offenses. It's about unintentional defilement. And in this case, something that's just sort of happening in the natural course of life. Leviticus 12 prescribes the quote unquote sin offering for a woman after she gives birth. I mean, what could be more natural than that? But there's no moral offense here. By the way, this is what Luke 2, 22 through 24 is referring to. And you know, when Mary, again, has to, you know, bring an offering after giving birth. Well, you know, I realize a lot of evangelicals use this to say, hey, you Catholics, Mary had a sin nature. Look at this. She brings a sin offering. Again, that's to misunderstand both the Mary situation and also what the sin offering was. It had nothing to do with I've offended God. You know, I'm guilty before God in some moral sense. It's like I had a baby. Well, again, because of the loss of blood, loss of bodily life fluid that we talked about in earlier episodes, you have become ritually impure. And so the katat is the prescribed procedure. So this alone should tell you that a translation in English like sin offering is a little misleading because it makes us think that there's something wrong with the person in a moral sense. And that is not the point of the sin offering. Again, and for all these reasons, some have opted for purification offering, but there's actually an actual textual exegetical reason why purification offering is better. And for this, you have to know a little bit of Hebrew, like I alluded to a few minutes ago. Now, if you're looking at this in a commentary, or maybe you're hearing a sermon, you might read or hear somebody say, hey, the word katat, sin offering, comes from the verb kata, which means to sin or miss the mark or to offend. And kata is spelled with three Hebrew letters, chet, tet, and aleph. You say, well, okay, well then if it comes from that verb to miss the mark, you know, to sin, to offend, well then surely the offering has something to do with moral offense. No, it doesn't. Because a lot of your preachers and even some of your commentators, at least the ones that are sort of oriented to the English Bible, will miss the fact that the noun katat here doubles the middle consonant. You say, well, what are you talking about, Mike? I said you have to know a little Hebrew to understand this. For those of you who have had some Hebrew, the middle consonant has a little dot in it. It's doubled. It's pet, tet, tet, aleph, and then the ending. Katat, the T ending. You say, well, who cares? This is like spelling trivia. It's actually important because what the doubled consonant tells us is that the noun translated quote-unquote sin offering is not just formed merely from this verb that means to miss the mark. It's formed from a specific form of that verb. One form in Hebrew grammar terminology, it's a stem. It's formed, the noun katat, sin offering, is formed from the PL stem of this verb lemma, one that doubles the second consonant. Now that's significant because in the PL stem, and stems are, they're not tenses. You might be thinking that's like tense in Hebrew. It's not, it's something different, but it has to do with meanings and patterns, things that happen to Hebrew verbs as they're used in writing or speaking. The PL stem of this verb means not to miss the mark. It doesn't mean to offend. What it means is to cleanse. It means to purify. I think a nice way of putting it is it means to decontaminate. And so if you recognize, because you know a little Hebrew, that katat is formed on the basis of the PL stem of the root verb, then you will know that sin offering is not a good translation of katat. The better translation would be purification offering, or I would even suggest decontamination offering. That captures the point of what is happening. And it's something that is, again, exegetically true. It's exegetically verifiable. So the quote-unquote sin offering, I would say, hey, if you're taking notes, you know, you put notes in the margin of your Bible, I'm not saying cross out words in your Bible, but you might want to put above the word sin offering, if you can, decontamination offering, because that's the point. It's the point of the verb in the PL stem. And since the noun here is formed from that stem verb, that's what it means. And that's why the blood is applied to the sanctuary and to sacred objects. It is shielding them. It is protecting them from infection. It is ensuring decontamination. It's like creating a clean room for those of you who are in engineering or maybe that work in computers. That's the idea. You just cleanse and decontaminate. You protect, you insulate the specific area, in this case, sacred space, from this person bringing the offering, this person who has inadvertently committed an offense. God accepts the offering because he's the one who laid out the system. He accepts the offering and says, okay, now that we've performed the offering, you are taken care of. The priest has, quote, here's our next couple terms that we need to discuss, made atonement for you and you shall be forgiven. Well, if you remember from a previous episode, we talked about the atonement verb, kippur in Hebrew. It comes from the Akkadian kupuru, which means to wipe off, or to wipe clean, to cleanse. It refers to the act of, again, cleansing or wiping away impurity, wiping away contamination. Now, that, again, differs a lot from what you will often read in more popular sources. Popular meaning, again, commentaries that are oriented only to the English Bible, or something you might hear a pastor say, or something that is quote unquote for the masses, that kind of thing. If anybody ever does that for Leviticus, but anyway, that's a lot different than what you're going to read in those sorts of sources where they'll say, well, kippur means to cover or to conceal, like you're hiding the sin from God's view. That is not what it means. Now, there are those ideas found elsewhere in the Hebrew Bible with other terms, but kippur, used in Leviticus, expresses the idea that through the ritual, the offerer and the sanctuary, the offerer is dealt with, he sinned inadvertently, committed an inadvertent offense, and bringing an offering now to make sure to decontaminate sacred space, to protect or insulate sacred space from his offense. Again, trying to avoid infection. And if the offerer does that, we call it good. So that the purification comes from God. Okay, God says, okay, you've taken care of my sanctuary. And God looks at the person bringing the katat, the purification offering, the decontamination offering, and says, you're good. You've done what I asked you to do when you have this inadvertent problem. And you did it in good faith. You obeyed. You did it with the right spirit. You did this in good faith, so to speak. We're okay now. Okay? Atonement has been made. Cleansing has occurred. You will no longer be infecting sacred space. You're no longer at risk. The sanctuary is protected. That's the idea. You say, well, what about the following phrase? You shall be forgiven, or he shall be forgiven. The meaning of that salak is the verb is you will be cleansed from impurity. In other words, God considers the inadvertent violation taken care of. You don't have to worry anymore. So it's not so much a release from guilt, since we're dealing with an inadvertent offense anyway. Okay, it's not so much release from guilt as being cleansed from the result of an inadvertent act. And remember, the quote-unquote sin offering, the katat, was used for things like childbirth. Again, we're not remedying a moral problem with the sin offering. Okay, if you don't accidentally commit adultery. Okay. I mean, if you commit a serious moral transgression deliberately, premeditatively, it's no accident. Your will was involved. You intended to do it. You did it voluntarily. Okay, that's a moral offense. And the katat offering is not going to take care of that in the Old Testament system. You're going to be cut off from the people. And in that case, it's the death penalty in Old Testament law. So again, we need to adjust the way we think about what the system was designed to do versus what it was not designed to do. I hope you're getting the impression it was really serious to sin deliberately. especially one of these again moral areas like adultery or something like that, there were some very, very serious consequences. You couldn't do this and say, oh, God will forgive me when I bring the bull. No, he won't. That's not what the sacrifice is for. You're going to be cut off. That's what the law says. Again, it's quite different, again, from what the New Testament through the work of Christ, what we're talking about there. I want to talk about one more thing, and that is we'll go back to the blood manipulation thing. I'm going to read a little bit from Averbeck that I think he puts this really nicely, summarizes it nicely. The place where the blood was applied or sprinkled or poured out, whatever, for the sin offering for the priest and the whole congregation is different from that of the tribal leader and the commoner. Okay, I mentioned this a few minutes ago, but here's what Averbeck says. He says, for the priest or the whole congregation, the priest sprinkled the blood with his finger 7 times in front of the veil of the sanctuary. In other words, the veil that separated the holy place inside the tent of meeting from the most holy place, the Holy of Holies, where the Ark of the Covenant was located. But some of the blood he put on the horns of the incense altar, again, within the holy place, but right there in front of the veil, on the other side of which is the Ark of the Covenant. So he sprinkled it at the veil, put some on the horns of the incense altar right there in front of the veil, shielding them from the Ark of the Covenant. And then the rest he poured out at the base of the altar of burnt offering located near the gate of the tabernacle complex. On the other hand, Averbeck says, the priest applied the blood of the leader, again, the tribal leader and the commoner, to the horns of the altar of the burnt offering. And that was outside the holy place. If you remember, again, the layout of the tabernacle, a lot of people have seen in study Bibles. So for the tribal leader and the commoner, the blood never penetrates into the holy place. The point is, Averbeck says, that the blood penetrated into the tabernacle complex as far as the contamination would have or did. The priest could enter the holy place, and the priest represented the congregation. So the blood of the sin offering for the priest or the whole congregation was administered inside the holy place because that's where priests could go. Since the non-Levitical, the non-priestly, non-Levitical, and I realize there's a difference there, but we'll just go with the broader category, non-Levitical leader, the tribal leader of Israel, or the common person, could only go into the tabernacle court, you know, outside the holy place, the courtyard area, and not beyond the altar of burnt offering. The atoning blood ritual of their sin offering, their katat, was performed at that altar, at the altar of burnt offering. In both cases, the blood went as far as the particular person or the collective group of persons being represented by the priest could proceed into the tabernacle complex. And therefore, the blood purified or cleansed the tabernacle up to that point. That was the main purpose of the sin offering, to purify, or one might say, decontaminate the tabernacle itself. One more observation from Averbeck before we finish up. He also says, in some instances, the result of bringing a sin offering was that the worshiper could, quote, be forgiven for their sin. By dealing with the contamination of the tabernacle that it had caused, again, once the tabernacle was protected, you were okay. Again, it's quite contrary to what we're thinking, you know, again, because we tend to filter our reading of Leviticus, by virtue of the New Testament. They're just dramatically different. I mean, by way of application, I mean, just think about, again, a Jew who heard the message of the gospel, who heard about what Jesus did on the cross. A Jew hears that what Jesus did covers every possible sin, intentional or unintentional. Everything is, quote unquote, under the blood. You can be cleansed and purified, made fit for sacred space, no matter what, because even if you sin defiantly in your past, now you're repentant, you have sorrow for your sin, you want to embrace the Messiah, you can be made new. You can be a new creature, a new creation. Concepts like that were totally foreign to that Jew who knew and understood the Levitical system, the Old Testament law. It was something so far beyond what they had in the Old Testament that it probably would have had a shocking effect. And I'm sure for someone who really cared, again, came to that place of repentance where they don't want to defy God and they do want forgiveness, you know, whether the death penalty was carried out, you know, in Second Temple times or New Testament times, we don't know. I mean, we have episodes in the Gospels like the woman taken in adultery, you know, and the whole stoning thing. And so we know that they were aware of it. They may have carried it out. Stephen was stoned because they thought they were stoning him for blasphemy. I mean, these things did happen. We have scant record of them, but there's indications that they did. Well, if you're, again, a Jew living in Judea, and you've, in your past, you know, committed these kinds of deliberate sins, without, you know, short of what these crazy Christians are saying now about the Messiah, and you know that there's something to it because you heard about Jesus, you might have seen, you know, a miracle he performed or whatever, you can see the apostles perform these miracles to validate the message. This is something that you want to hear, and that is just revelatory. You mean to tell me that I can actually be forgiven? God looks at me as though I you know, I'm pure now. Looks at me as though I'd never done it. For even these deliberate sins that I have committed in my life at some point. Is that what you're saying? And the apostles would go, yep. You know, that's what we're saying. That was the point of what happened on the cross. I mean, there's just nothing like that sort of thinking in the Old Testament. Again, for us, for them, for us, there's no restriction in forgiveness to just unintentional sins. And not only that, but the New Testament is focused on moral absolution, even for deliberate rebellion. It's not just decontamination. It's being made right with God. It's being put in Christ so that when God looks at you, he sees the perfection of Jesus, the Messiah. I mean, again, these concepts are so far beyond what you would have had in the Old Testament. So, you know, when the writer of the book of Hebrews is like, you people who are lapsing back into unbelief or whatever, you're insane. Don't you realize how much better Jesus is? And again, the book of Hebrews goes through this whole litany of how Jesus is better. And one of those is the sacrifice. The blood of bulls and goats could not take away sin. Think about that statement. The blood of the bulls and goats is applied to the sanctuary. It's about decontaminating the place. It's not about taking away your guilt. It's not about moral absolution. The blood of bulls and goats could not do this, but the blood of Christ can. Again, it's just a dramatic difference. So I'm hoping as we go through Leviticus, you not only learn a little bit more about how the Israelite would have thought about what we're reading in Leviticus, how they would have processed it, what it would have meant, but also how much better the whole whole fully developed biblical theology mediated through the Messiah, the whole doctrine of salvation and forgiveness that were presented in the New Testament, how much superior that really is compared to what had gone before.
Mike, is there any significance as to why a female goat or lamb for the common people and a male bull or goat for the others?
A lot figure that the female, the livestock, I'll just say it, was of lesser value in the herd than the male, because the male could produce, you know, the male could impregnate multiple, you know, females, and they could, you know, obviously give birth. So the male was more valued because of the way it could reproduce. And that if you lose a female, okay, you lose one that could give birth. If you lose a male, it's like, good grief. We just lost an animal that could have reproduced 100 times, you know. So if you look at these passages where it's probably too much to say that this is the way it works every time, but I'm pretty safe in saying this is the way it works most times. Again, I'd have to look just to be completely sure 100% of the time this is what's going on. But the female is either for a person of lesser status or a person who's poor, as opposed to, you know, the other. And it might be a reflection of what you can afford to lose. You know, that sort of thing. You know, what you can sacrifice so that your livelihood is not decimated, as opposed to, again, what some other person, you know, could give. Or again, it's a reflection of the status within the community of the offerer. But again, this is an agrarian society. It's not totally subsistence living, but it's settled agriculture and whatnot. So it's a little bit above subsistence living, but it really mattered based upon, again, the value placed on the animal, that some of these choices, you know, are made and things are laid out the way they are.
That whole concept of decontamination offering, I think it really drives it home.
Yeah, it's a good word.
It is. It's a completely different comprehension of it.
It's kind of interesting because you're beginning to see in the Old Testament that the ritual was really about the sanctity of God, you know, and his living space. Where in the New Testament, the emphasis of forgiveness and the blood of Christ is really about the sinner. You know, it's just quite a different way of looking at things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's good. It's good. We're already in chapter 4 and it's already getting good.
Well, even Leviticus has something interesting in it. If we can do a podcast and get through Leviticus and people learn something and they find it interesting, we can do anything.
Yeah, well, I think when you told people not to cross out the word sin offering and put in decontamination, I think you should do that.
Okay, well, there you go.
Well, all right. Well, that's good.
We don't want our questioner saying, why are you violating Revelation 22, or whatever. That isn't the point.
Well, all right, Mike. Did you have any speaking engagements that are coming up that you wanted to mention?
Yeah, I want to say something about the event in Missouri on October 2nd and 3rd. I'm going to be at Missouri Western State University in St. Joseph, Missouri, really for 2 days. One's a Friday night, one's a Saturday morning into the early afternoon. And this is going to be a campus event. The person who's my contact on that end works at the university, and so he has really done a lot of work to make this happen. It's coordinated with student groups, Christian student groups like Navigators, InterVarsity, whatnot. There's going to be obviously people from local churches in the area there. We'll get students and faculty, but it's part of university calendar, you know, some sort of academic colloquium. I'm not sure what term that they're actually going to use in their publication, but this is sort of an official university event, and I'll be there, like I said, 2 days. Friday night, I'm going to be the theme for the Friday night is the Bible Unfiltered, and that's going to be the evening where I'm going to do 3 lectures, so it's going to be 3 hours. Supernatural Worldview of the Old Testament, so essentially the Divine Counsel Worldview of the Old Testament, in 1 hour. The Godhead of the Old Testament, so the two powers thing, will be another hour. And then the supernatural worldview of the New Testament. So again, a divine council worldview of the New Testament. So that's Friday night, October 2nd. The next day, Saturday, my theme for that is how to take the Bible out of context. And what I mean by that is I'm going to go through examples where Christians have sort of intended to interpret the content of the Bible to suit modern causes or controversies. And by doing so, they don't let the Bible be what it is. So one lecture, I'm going to have 4 lectures here. So it's 4 hours of the second day. And I'll have Q&A after these, you know, both on Friday night and on Saturday as well. But the 4 hours on Saturday are the pagan Christ. So why correlation and causation really aren't the same thing. I'm going to be talking about zeitgeist kind of things there. The whole idea that Jesus never existed and how that's articulated and defended and why it's absurd. I'm going to do another lecture on the Gnostic Christ, basically an overview of Gnosticism, Gnostic cosmology, and how they think about Jesus and how that sort of drifts into the way some people today think about Jesus and talk about Jesus, and what they're really articulating is Gnosticism. Another lecture will be why Genesis 1:1-3 doesn't help young earth creationism. It's basically why the grammar and syntax of the first 3 verses of your Bible really open the door to different interpretations of the creation story. That one, some of you may have seen online. I've done that lecture at my own church before. And then the last one will be biblical racism. That is the side effect of presuming the Bible teaches science that you won't hear in church. And this is really dealing with how, again, because of the biblical writers and their sort of, you know, narrow, restricted view of what nations existed. Again, they don't know about India and China and North America and South America. Genesis 10 gives us the nations, 70 nations that are in the Mediterranean and the ancient Near East. Well, when you get to the modern world, beginning in the 16th century, when you start finding people on the other side of the world and, you know, other countries that are discovered and, you know, people of other races, well, you know, what do we do with that? You know, how do we make the Bible fit this circumstance? And it was that crisis in modern European history that essentially led to racism. I mean, people were using the Bible to essentially say, well, these other races are the descendants of Ham and they're cursed. You know, we have to fit these Indian people or these Native Americans. We got to fit them into the Bible somewhere. And, oh, here's a good place. And you know, it happens to be this cursed line. So how the Bible is essentially used to try to address science and scientific finding, discovery, and how it resulted in an unfortunate, terrible distortion of biblical theology and sort of the aftermath of what that produced. So again, Saturday is how to take the Bible out of context. So I'm doing four lectures on, again, some of the stranger ideas, how the Bible is misused to articulate certain things. So that'll be Saturday. So Friday night's sort of Divine Council night. Saturday is, you know, some of this other stuff, but that's October 2nd and 3rd.
Do you know if the university plans on recording that and providing that?
You know, I don't know yet. I think if they don't officially, I think that the person who I'm organizing this will, I will probably take something just in case to record it, at least on audio. I mean, I have a recorder I can take that I will bring along as a backup, but I would like them recorded even if I have to do it myself. I don't know how great that'll turn out, but the plan is to have some recording. I just don't know who's going to end up doing it.
Okay. Well, good deal. I'm jealous for all the people in that area, so try to make it if you can.
That'll be St. Joseph, Missouri.
All right. Well, good deal. And what's the date for that again?
October 2nd and 3rd. Now, I should say, and I haven't said anything about this on the blog or whatnot, so this is a podcast extra. I'm actually going to be in Missouri longer than the 3rd. I'm going to be there till the 7th, and the reason is because after I'm done at St. Joseph, I'm going to be driving the 4.5 or 5 hours or whatever it is down to Crane, Missouri, and I'm going to be recording with Tom Horn. Some of the listeners will know who Tom Horn is, and the Raiders News Network guy. Well, he has a TV show. So I'm going to be recording for him and just visiting, because I've met Tom before at a Roswell conference, but I've never been to his place. So that'll be a sort of probably at least a day of actual vacation.
Do you know what the topic? Do you know what the topic will be?
I don't know. I don't. I think. Trying to go back in my head here quickly through some emails. I sent him a copy of Unseen Realm. He wanted that. So my guess is that we will be talking about the book specifically. I don't know how long the segment will be, if it'll be more than one or two segments. I don't know. But Derek Gilbert's down there too. So I haven't ever met Derek face-to-face, but Derek works with Tom, you know, on his show. So I'll be down there taping something. It probably, again, Divine Council stuff for the book, but how much of it, how many segments, I don't know yet.
Did you ever hear back from the George Norrie show that you did in the spring?
Well, I heard that was going to be released in September, like mid-September. I haven't actually gone to the Gaiam TV website to see that I'm up there. Maybe I am. I don't know. I tend to just go and do these things and never look. So that's the best I can do.
Maybe you're up there as we speak. Maybe you.
I could be. Who knows?
We'll have to go.
Who knows?
Well, all right, Mike. All that sounds good. Is there anything else you'd like to mention?
No, I think that's it.
Okay. I just want to say thanks for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. God bless.
Thanks for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit www.nakedbibleblog.com. To learn more about Dr. Heiser's other websites and blogs, go to www.drmsh.com.